are listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Allie Lightfoot. Local Motion is KVNF's weekly program that focuses on local arts, public affairs, and news. We highlight people, ideas, and projects in our area that are innovative and moving us forward. On today's show, we're featuring an IC Change special on animals. I'm here with IC Change producer Julia Kumari-Drabkin and biologists Michael Soule and Chris Floyd. We'll be playing clips of your questions about animals, and we have several scientists and naturalists to answer those questions. You can be a part of this conversation and call with questions or observations at 970-527-4868.
KVNF receives support from members and from Weehawken Creative Arts, announcing the 28th Annual Ridgeway Rendezvous Arts and Crafts Festival at Ridgeway Town Park, Saturday, August 11th and Sunday, August 12th, featuring over 140 vendors and artists, children's activities, and entertainment. Info at weehawkenarts.org.
Blues and Other Colors is underwritten in part by the next generation of Vogie's House Moving, serving Western Colorado. NOAA can be reached at 240-8175.
Listening to us on KVNF 90.9 in Paonia and KVMT 89.1 in Montrose and on the web at kvnf.org. And we're here with our special IC Change special on animals. Here's Julia.
Thanks, Allie. The IC Change Project has been talking to both citizens and scientists about changes they've seen this year, and it's been quite a year for change. We've talked about early spring, weird weather, drought, and long-term climate trends here in Western Colorado. But we finally got some rain, and we wanted to turn our attention to the next for the next several weeks to animals. I've been getting observations and questions from local residents and scientists, and we're lucky in the North Fork Valley and the Western Slope to have many residents who happen to be scientists. One of them is here with me in the studio, Paonia resident Michael Soule. Michael is not only a population biologist, he is the founder of an entirely new field of biology. He pioneered conservation biology, an interdisciplinary approach to science that takes into account the impacts humans have on nature, ecology, and population genetics. He's written books, textbooks, founded the Wildlands Network, worked all over the world, and has picked this area on the Western Slope to call home. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
I'm glad to be here, Julia, in my hometown.
And also joining us on the phone is another biologist and kind of a neighbor. Chris Floyd is a biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and a longtime researcher at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab in Gothic, just over that mountain pass. He studies all kinds of animals, squirrels, marmots, skunks, and birds here in the Rocky Mountains and how they relate ecologically to each other. In fact, he's calling us from the Ecological Society of America meeting in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Chris, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, Julia.
All right. Now, Chris and Michael, I believe you know each other from the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. Chris, you said you worked together in the early 90s?
Yes, yeah, coming up on a quarter century ago.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
For our listeners tuning in, would you guys tell us a little bit about the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab?
Yes. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I've been there probably longer over the years than you have, but you have a lot more recent experience than I do. I started going there in 1962 when I was a graduate student with Paul Ehrlich, and went there many years and had a lot of volunteers working with me, and had a lot of fun. Met one of my wives there, so lots happened there over the years. My kids even kind of grew up there in the summers.
I was just there recently, and it's very much a community that reminds me of Paonia, of the North Fork Valley, but it's a science community just over that pass. And we're excited to speak with you both. Chris, I know you've been working there for several years as well, and just following what's been going on here. We encourage our listeners to call in with their animal observations. If you've been following what's been going on with animals this year, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 527-4868 or toll-free 1-866-KVNF now. We want to hear about the changes you've seen lately. This is kind of scripted, but not really. We have lots of questions from people we've already taken from text message, from Facebook, as well as in person. And we've got a few answers to those questions. I'll be talking to Jeff Reynolds, our extraordinary engineer, to play those clips as we talk. But first up, we have Sue Hush, who reached out to us from Telluride. Sue sent us her observation via cell phone. She texted the word IC to the number 877-877 and left us this question about chipmunks.
Hi, I was just texting my question about chipmunks. We've had so many more chipmunks, and I know they're hungry, but there seems to be a lot of them for a year that's so dry.
So similar to Sue's question, we also received a question from Cassandra Shank. She lives on Rogers Mesa outside of Hotchkiss, and she says this year she's seen squirrels for the first time. Well, lots of them, but they weren't alive. Let's let her explain.
Well, I drive down 3200 Road on Rogers Mesa probably four times a day, and I have probably done so for the past 6 years. I don't know if I'm alone in this, but I always notice roadkill, and I kind of count it. I don't know why, but I try to sort of identify it as it's zooming by. And it's easy to identify skunks and other things. But lately, and just this spring, I have been noticing squirrels. And it's like all of a sudden the squirrels have moved onto our mesa, because one day I remember there being like three squirrels within the span of not even a mile, three roadkill squirrels. And I can't say that I've ever remember seeing a squirrel on our mesa before. I'm pretty sure we haven't had them, because my kids, you know how kids love squirrels. One day this spring, they looked over at our woodpile and they said, "Mommy, look, a squirrel." And they were so excited. And I think based on that, and the fact that I have three kids and they're young and we've been there and outside for years, I think that's like, I don't remember them ever seeing a squirrel. I don't think I've ever seen a squirrel. So yeah, squirrels have appeared, and I'm wondering why.
So Michael, do you have any thoughts as to why?
Well, we've had two very different but extraordinary years in different ways. The year before this one, it was extraordinarily wet. We had 200% normal precipitation that year. And that had a huge impact on wildlife. And in very wet years, you can count on rodents reproducing like crazy. And because there's so much vegetation, so much food, so many seeds being produced by grasses and other plants. So there's a population explosion of squirrels that happened last year, starting in the spring. And it's not really over. It's still reverberating. Although this year was really dry, there were many squirrels reproducing last year, so their babies are out now. And a lot of them are getting run over on the roads, because juvenile rodents and other juvenile animals are really naive. And starting in the spring, when they start to wander around, they get into trouble, get squashed.
So, Chris, I know that you've studied squirrels as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how the changing weather, maybe the changing climate over time, has it affected their movements here in the Rocky Mountains?
It really depends on which species of squirrel you're talking about. Some species of squirrels, like the golden mantle ground squirrels, hibernate, and they really depend on having a thick layer of snow covering their burrow to insulate it from the cold temperatures. Even if it's minus 20 out down in the burrow, it'll be a comfortable, what would be for them, a comfortable 34 degrees. However, last year was a very low snowfall year, and then it was an early snow melt, a warm, dry spring. However, the snow did melt relatively early, earlier than normal, and cold air may have seeped down into those burrows, and that does not, that typically harms hibernating species. So that's a species that probably would be harmed by early snow melt in the kind of year we had last year, whereas other species, perhaps the rock, I suspect what are rock squirrels, what you're seeing there, may actually be helped by having a less severe winter. So it really depends on the species. But I do want to make one note of the roadkill. Those are individuals, very often are juveniles and naive individuals that are having basically being forced out of their home range by their parents and have to move on to find other breeding opportunities. However, a lot of rodents get killed on the road scavenging other rodents. That's one of the reasons why you see sometimes two or three squirrels or prairie dogs killed in one area, is that some of those individuals went out to scavenge the dead individuals that got run over. Kind of a vicious cycle.
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead, Allie.
About roadkill.
Sure.
Since we're on the topic, why is it that, you know, I mean, what is it that we normally see as roadkill? I see mostly skunks, but I'm just wondering if there's like a particular animal that is more inclined to be playing that game in the road. And also the game that chipmunks play where they run out and then run back. Like, is that a game? Because they really look like they're
playing.
Yeah.
Well, there's Chris, I believe you studied skunks. Is that right?
I studied population genetics of skunks on an island in California.
Oh, okay.
But I know a little bit about them.
Well, we're definitely going to be returning to roadkill and roadkill dynamics with a few questions that we've had about birds. But I wanted to follow up on Sue and Cassandra's observation, because I did find someone who is seeing the same thing that they're seeing at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. Her name is Caitlin Wells. She's a researcher with no office. She just walks around with a clipboard and binoculars. And so let's hear what she's been seeing this year.
So when it comes to chipmunks, Sue, and squirrels, Cassandra, I've been seeing the same thing. Short winters can be really good for small animals. Both of those species hibernate over winter as a way to deal with the fact that there's no food and it's very cold. So hibernation is a great strategy to deal with the lack of food, but it's also expensive, energetically. You have to spend a lot of energy to stay warm and to wake yourself up in the spring. So when winters are shorter, animals have more body fat in the spring than they usually do. And in my research, I've found that females who wake up from hibernation with more body fat have larger litters. So they'll have more babies than usual, which could be driving the larger population sizes that you're seeing this year.
So they have more body fat because they're not as cold?
They're not spending it all being as cold underground during hibernation. So in a short winter, they get to save all of that extra energy and put it into more babies instead of just burning it to stay warm.
So we had this really mild winter, which mm-hmm. was great, but now we've had this really dry spring mm-hmm. and summer. And what is that doing to chipmunks and squirrels?
I'm not sure yet. We've had dry summers before, about 10 years ago, and usually early snow melt is good. The females mate when they first emerge from hibernation, and the earlier they mate, the earlier they have their babies. So not only might we see more chipmunks and squirrels this summer, but with more babies possibly surviving over their first hibernation, we might see more next summer too. And I guess it makes the foxes happy too.
Who else eats squirrels and chipmunks?
Squirrels and chipmunks are snacks for a wide variety of carnivores. So foxes, coyotes, weasels, long-tailed weasels around here eat a lot of chipmunks and voles and squirrels.
Well, Amber Kleineman said that she saw a weasel for the first time in Paonia, and she's never seen one before. So maybe that has something to do with having more food?
Yes, they will move to find food. And I've seen more weasels this summer than in the past several years as well. So they might be doing quite well with the larger number of chipmunks and squirrels this year, too.
So Amber might be onto something.
I think so.
Whoa.
Good observation, Amber.
So as you can hear, IC Change is a community conversation with environmental scientists. And Amber Kleineman texted us her observation about weasels to our Change hotline. We want to hear what you're seeing change too. We're documenting all four seasons. And if you have an observation or a question, just text the word IC to the phone number 877-877. Or you can like us. We have an IC Change Facebook page where you can post your pictures and your questions there. Now, this next question comes to us from a super smart 9-year-old, Mason Lightfoot. And full disclosure, this is the son of Local Motion hostess with me, Allie Lightfoot. Now, Allie, you explained to Mason how to use our text service and how to post to Facebook. And what did he ask you?
Well, he wanted to know about horny toads, and we'll hear about his question. But he also asked if he could he just wanted to ask Julia because he sees her around. So he just was like, I just want to ask Julia when I see her next time. I don't want to text 877. But I think we got him to do it, right?
We did. But I'd like to remind listeners that Mason is correct. You can come into the studio. You can stop me if you see me. I'll be at the Delta County Fair or at the Pickin in the Park concert series here in Paonia through August. I'll have a big fuzzy microphone that looks like a dead cat's on it. So face-to-face is just as good as Facebook here at IC Change. But let's listen to this young man's story.
2 years ago when I went to science camp, I still am in science camp, there used to be these lizards called horny toads everywhere. Like you could just catch it through the fence if you wanted to catch one. But now you can't even find one. Like if you wanted a chance to see one, you would have to like look it up or something. Like it just takes forever to find a horny toad. They look like toads except for the lizards covered with spikes. And to me they remind me of dinosaurs, and they're just really cool. And the weird fact about them is that if you really make one mad or scared, they actually cry blood. And that sometimes, that hasn't happened to me yet, but it's happened to a kid once in science camp. And I think they've probably went away because all the kids pretty much caught them all, so they know not to go over by the fence and by the school. So, basically, I guess this year, since there's no horny toads, I've seen a lot more animals that I haven't seen before. Like, yesterday I saw a rattlesnake and I almost stepped on it, but then stuck its head up and I had to run away. But it's changed a lot more than it has been.
So if you were going to ask a scientist a question about horny toads this year, what would you ask?
I would ask him, why couldn't you see them and why aren't they like there? Ask him if he could actually find one for me, because I've looked my hardest, so.
So there's a lot of great observations in there. Mason thinks that one of the reasons that there aren't as many horny toads this year has to do with the kids in camp catching them. Now, Michael, last we spoke about Mason's question, you mentioned that might be the case.
Yes, exactly. I was a kid, and I loved to pick up horned lizards, as we scientists call them, because they're not toads. But he's absolutely right. I think the major enemy of horned lizards and many other small creatures are little boys. Little boys tend to pick up reptiles and amphibians and whatever they see and bring them home, and especially if they're cute. And horny toads, though they're kind of horny, are cute too. And at least boys think they're cute, and they put them in a tank, an aquarium, or in a large jar, and they watch them. And eventually, of course, they don't do too well in a jar or a tank, so they die. Or if they're rescued in time, maybe you can take them back. But the habit that little boys have of picking up something, a creature like a horned lizard, is a major cause of their disappearance in urban or suburban areas, not so much way out in the country where the density of little boys isn't so high. But around towns, they disappear. Because they're so attractive, everybody wants to pick one up and say, "What's that? Well, I'm going to take it. Put it in my pocket. I'm going to take it home."
We found a toad once, just sitting on his bookshelf He just came in and set it down right there. You know, why not? Just keep it right there.
Oh, well, he just wants to, everyone loves the animals. And so how? What are the good ways that you think that, you know, boys and girls can engage with animals? What advice do you have for them?
Well, you can pick up some of them. Some of them aren't harmed, including horned lizards. Most lizards aren't harmed by picking them up, unless you pick them up by their tail, and then they'll drop their tail and they'll have to regenerate a new one. And that's really bad on their status. In a community of lizards, if you're the one who lost its tail, your status is really low. So, and you can't find a mate. Mm. So that's one of the sad things about losing your tail. But you can pick them up if you're a little boy. It's okay. But then put them back so that they have a chance to live, because they'll starve to death, or you'll end up taking them back, but not to exactly the same place you found them. And then you put them in a territory of another lizard or some predator, and they'll get eaten or chased away.
Oh, wow. Well, that's actually really good advice. I wouldn't have thought that, actually. But I actually have heard something from Chris, actually, with regards to horny toads. There's something else going on with them, not just here in the North Fork, but worldwide. Chris, what's going on with horny toads?
Well, first of all, I want to say that Mason's reminds me of myself when I was a kid. That's pretty much how I got into biology, was catching water snakes in Missouri.
Nice.
But Michael's definitely right. Human disturbance is a big factor in the decline of horned lizards, which is happening all over North America. And in some places in Texas, for example, they've been eliminated in entire counties in Texas. They're gone. Not just people picking them up, though, but development, basically land being developed for housing developments and agriculture. And another factor that's hurting horned lizards is the introduction of invasive ants, species of ants that are not from here, but they come in and they outcompete our native ants, because that's what horned lizards mainly eat, is ants. So they're the ants they prefer are being wiped out by introduced ants.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's the case right there in your area, the North Fork, but that is happening elsewhere in North America.
Well, actually, we have seen a lot of ants. I'm going to ask Jeff to pull up Lance's question about ants. We have had a question from Lance Swigart, who grows an incredible garden here. Our listeners will know him from his weekly show, As the Worm Turns. And Lance is helping the IC Change Project as we develop our digital farmer's almanac, a place online where gardeners and ranchers and farmers and recreationists can share their observations, swap advice, and keep records online from year to year. So Lance doesn't have a phone and he's not online, but he comes in and chats with me every week. And last week he told me he's never seen so many ants in his garden, ever.
Sugar ants are, I've never even seen them in my garden. I've seen them out and about, but, you know, I probably have 15 to 20 ant hills, you know, here and there throughout the garden. And I was just curious. And they're eating every bit of fruit that hits the ground.
So he's seeing lots of ants on the ground. Chris, do you have any thoughts about ants that he's seeing?
I haven't really noticed any change this year in ants, but you know, it's been such a, like we've talked about, such a weak winter and early spring and dry conditions that it's yet another example of an animal whose its abundance has increased because of they're perhaps. The conditions are more favorable for them. It's just simply warmer, they survive better.
Actually, I talked to biologist David Inouye, who's worked with both of you at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. He's actually, I think, in Portland at that meeting with you. I met him on Kepler Pass last week in a field he's been studying for 40 years. And normally it's full of wildflowers, but this year it's full of dried out corn lilies. And on their leaves, we can see very, very busy ants and tons of tiny aphids. They look like little black dots. So let's hear what he has to say about Lance's question.
Well, one of the problems that ants have is infections with fungus. And so it could be that the fact that it's been a little bit drier this year means that there hasn't been as much of a problem for the ants, and therefore there are more of them. These ants that we're seeing here, these red and black ants, are a kind that's called Formica Formica obscuripes, and they get that genus name because they actually use formic acid as a defensive spray. They can bite, but they can't break your skin, but you can feel them pinching if you get one on your finger, and they don't sting. But here at Horse Ranch Park, there are a lot of nests. We walked past one mound over there. Maybe you can see.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, it's a little mound over there. I see it.
Yeah, and I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 or 8 more of those ant nests. There's probably a dozen that we can see here within 50 yards.
Actually, now that you've pointed them out, they're like little mountains all over the place. Look at that. That's 1, yeah. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Whoa.
Yeah, so this meadow, I'm not sure why, but this meadow is really full of those ant nests, ants that are tending the aphids here.
So the aphids seem to be doing great this year, too? I mean, what's the deal?
I don't know why there's so many. I guess I'm wondering whether it might be because these plants are somewhat stressed this year between the frost and the dry weather, and it could be maybe that they're not making as much in the way of defensive compounds. Maybe that's something to do with it. Or it could be that it's just a really good season for aphids for reasons that I don't know. It's just that I know that most years when I walk through this meadow, I don't see nearly so many plants with aphids on them.
The ants defend the aphids because the aphids give them sugar?
The aphids are here all over the leaves. They've got their mouth parts stuck into the veins, the plant veins, and they're sucking sap, and plant sap has a lot of sugars in it and very little in the way of amino acids, which is what the aphids need to grow. And so they filter out the amino acids, and then they have all this extra water and extra sugar from filtering out the sap, what they need out of the sap. And some aphids, what they'll do is they'll retain that liquid, and then when they're stroked by an ant, they'll release it, and the ants collect it and use it for food. So it's an interesting mutualism between the ants and the aphids. It's almost like a farmer tending his cows. So if there are enemies like syrphid flies or ladybug beetle larvae or wasps that would eat or lay eggs in the aphids, the ants will chase those off. And
that is so cool. So the ants are really like farmers and ranchers, kind of.
Yeah, and I think sometimes they'll move them from plant to plant or from part of the plant to part of the plant. So, it is a pretty neat relationship.
And you're tuned into Local Motion on KBNF, and it's an IC Change special on animals. We're here with Julia Kumari-Drapkin, who's the IC Change producer, as well as biologists Michael Soulet and Chris Floyd. Stay tuned. Rosie Ledette has carved out a unique spot in the Zydeco Pantheon. She's one of a handful of female accordionists singing in both Creole, French, and English. She's known for her songwriting ability as well as her bluesy, sexy singing voice. Tune in to KBNF Live this Thursday at 7 p.m. to hear Rosie Ledette and the Zydeco Playboys performing live from Paonia Town Park. That's KBNF Live this Thursday at 7 p.m.
KBNF receives support from listeners and from Infria Wizerk Conservation Center, a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting rivers, public lands, and quality of life in Delta County since 1977. The Conservation Center welcomes new members and may be contacted at 527-5307 and theconservationcenter.org.
This program on KVNF is supported by the Rotary Club of Paonia, geared to service in the local community. The Rotary Club provides college scholarships to area youth to help them reach their educational goals. More information available at 527-4585.
We're back for another half hour. We're discussing animals on IC Change. And Julia Kumari-Drapkin is here with biologists Michael Soulet and Chris Floyd. And we can take your questions as well. Give us a call. 527-4868 is the number to call. Julia?
Thanks, Allie. So Michael was just saying that a lot of the questions that we've had so far and a lot of the ones that we're about to discuss kind of relate to the same things that have been going on in the environment. What were you saying?
I was saying, Julia, that we've had two blows to the natural history, to the biology this year, but they benefit some creatures. One is a mild winter, which means things get off to an early start. They get a leg up on the seasons, and they start reproducing earlier, feeding earlier, and then the early spring, when it was warmer, gets them going even faster. So the combination of a mild winter and an early spring probably accounts for a lot of the things we're seeing, like a good year for aphids. They got an early start, and a good year for mosquitoes, too. It's a really great year for mosquitoes.
Oy, yoy, yoy, as one of my icy changers said. Yeah,
and that was probably because it was an early spring and a mild winter. They overwintered well. There wasn't probably much death during the winter in their early stages. And having an early start makes a huge difference demographically. If you have an early start, if you're an animal like a mosquito or an aphid, you get going. You reproduce earlier, and by the end of the year, the population can be many times what it would have been without that early spring.
Mark Schwartz, a regular contributor to the IC Change Project, studies the start of spring. He's appeared in several of our stories, and he. Many others have noted that this is the earliest start of spring, the earliest beginning of the growing season, since many weather records were kept in 1895, maybe even earlier. So that is a big deal. Chris, you're at the Ecological Society of America meeting in Portland. Is that a big topic of conversation?
Absolutely. There's probably at least 7 organized sessions on climate change and the effect on animals and plants.
Anything that catches your eye or anything interesting that we should pay attention to?
Well, it's all the talks that I've looked at, the titles are all interesting to some degree. They're all and I think there's not one in particular.
I know you just arrived. I know you had a long flight. Yeah. But do keep us posted about surprises at that meeting, and we'll definitely be keeping you posted. Again, this is a conversation between citizens and scientists about environmental change. And we'd like to come back to Lance Swaggart, who has another question about birds. We've been getting lots and lots and lots of bird questions lately. So let's hear Lance's question.
The robins made a second nest in the garden this year, and I thought that was unusual considering the drought conditions. You know, so I don't know what's in their time clock. Is it going to rain a lot more, or is it just because of my garden? Who knows?
So your question is, what are robins paying attention to?
What are they paying attention to that they're making a second nest?
Chris, any thoughts on what robins may be paying attention to that would cue them to make a second nest?
Well, that's a really great observation, and that's something that's actually been noted in the scientific literature. It's been shown over and over again is that robins are getting more nests in per year. In the past, in the Rocky Mountains, most likely robins got only one nest in a year. Now they can get 2 fairly easily, and even 3 in some cases. And we're seeing that at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab as well. Robins show up months earlier than they did just a few decades ago, and they're getting more nests in now, too. So what you're seeing, what Lance is seeing, is something that's happening all over North America.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I'm sure lots of bird populations are starting to enjoy having these mild winters and early springs. But I went ahead, and because we've had so many questions about birds, I went ahead and talked to another neighbor here in Paonia. He's also a scientist and an expert on local birds, and you probably know him from the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. Let's hear what he has to say. That would be Jason Beeson talking about robins.
My name is Jason Beeson. I work for Rocky Mountain Bird Observatory, and I'm the Special Monitoring Projects Coordinator. Is my title, and that involves mostly inventorying western Colorado and all of Colorado for low-density bird species, mostly.
And you live in Paonia?
Yep. I live a mile west of Paonia on the North Fork of the Gunnison River.
All right. So we have a question from Lance about robins building two nests within one season. Is that normal behavior?
Yeah, that's pretty normal. A lot of the species, you know, that arrive fairly early in the spring, like robins, you know, they'll be back in early April, and they'll probably start working on building a nest or, you know, at least forming pairs pretty quickly. And, you know, I'll start seeing fledglings, you know, like late May, early June. So they've already, had a successful nest, and so they will start doing it again. So I think I saw some recent fledglings in my yard this morning. So they're probably maybe a second clutch, you know, somewhere around my yard. So that's pretty normal for robins, yeah.
Well, you pay a lot of attention to birds. Mm-hmm. Do you think that some of these species have been affected by the changing weather?
Oh, yeah. The robins is a good example of, you know, Christmas bird counts. Or a lot more of them are showing up on winter counts at more northern latitudes. Since I've been here, it's not unusual for me to think, oh, there's a robin in the winter. But you talk to a lot of the old timers, they're like, oh, they're spending the winter here now. So that's something fairly new.
Wow. I'd love to hear if any of the listeners listening now have seen robins overwintering. What else have you seen that's been unusual in terms of birds in the area?
This spring, I think a lot of people, you know, since it was warm so early, were thinking that migration was going to be early, but it didn't really seem like that happened. And if anything, it seemed like a lot of things returned late. And talking with other birders, it seemed like typically in the spring we have, you know, storms or, you know, some weather that it kind of causes birds to, you know, like accumulate in one area. And it didn't seem like that happened. You know, like, and sometimes you go to, you know, Paonia Town Park in early May if there's, you know, a rainstorm or, you know, or the mountains are getting snow still, and you'll see lots of, you know, like western tanagers or black-headed grosbeaks in flocks there. And this year I didn't see anything like that where there was, you know, like a accumulation of migrants in one little area. It's like they just went right to the places where they were going to breed and stayed there and, you know, and bred. And I've talked with a lot of other birders or ornithologists, and they seems like a lot of people observe that same thing, or it seemed like that's what happened.
Oh, wow. We'd love to hear more from our listeners what they're seeing with birds and if there was any unusual behavior or questions they have this year. We'll be talking to Jason a lot for the next couple of weeks, talking about some of your lightning bugs in your backyard. That's an ongoing story, so stay tuned to KVNF for that. But in the meantime, we have a question from Andrea Lakos. She posted on Facebook, on the Paonia message board, and on Icy Change that for the past month, she's been finding dead birds along O Road and Lamborn Mesa Road, mostly in her yard, and they are mostly sparrows, a couple of finch, one juvenile thrush, or a kestrel. Mm-hmm. She's wondering what causes it, since none of these birds really are typical carriers of the West Nile virus or infected by the West Nile virus. Okay. And a few other people on the message board have thought maybe the drought could be responsible. Any thoughts about that?
I don't really know. I'd have to see what kind of birds, you know, the house sparrows, or definitely could be the drought. I know the ditches up in that area got shut off early. They have to travel further to get to the water. Or I've been noticing a lot of pine siskins, which are typically mountain breeding birds, but they also breed down around here, that are eating the dandelion seeds. And there's a lot of species of plants, it seems like, that grow along roads that have seeds that they like. So, you know, just being near the roads, they're more vulnerable to, you know, to traffic and cars. And that could be drought-related, because it seems like things stay greener along the roads also. You know, I don't know why, but the water maybe builds up when it runs off the roads when it does rain.
We'll tell Andrea to go ahead and keep an eye out to see if she sees birds actually eating on the sides of the road. But just more generally, do you think that the drought could be affecting birds in general? And people have been saying they want to put out some water to keep them quenched.
Yeah, that would definitely help. You know, a lot of people have the water baths, which draw in a lot of birds, you know, especially if you're in a dry area where there's, you know, where birds would have to travel a long way to get water. That would probably lure the birds in and provide water for them. So I have been noticing evening grosbeaks already coming into Paeonia, which is kind of a species of concern, if you will, like a declining species. And it seems early to me for them to be coming out of the mountains. Typically, they breed, you know, at high elevations, and where I always think of them is like, you know, in the fall, they start coming back down into town and before they go wherever they go for the winter. They're not a long-distance migrant, but they do, you know, kind of that elevational migration. But already they're, you know, flying over my house and moving around a lot, so that seems kind of odd to me. I don't know, it'd be good for maybe Michael Soule or Chris Floyd to see what they say about them.
So Michael, Chris, Jason wanted to know if you had any thoughts about evening grosbeaks coming down early. What do you think, Michael?
Well, the problem in general is that it was a very dry spring and early summer. And as a result of that, there's very little food in the mountains this year for a lot of creatures, including birds. So that would precipitate an early migration down the mountains into the river valleys like where we live here in Paeonia. So it's not surprising that a lot of things will be coming down early this year, including bears, but also a lot of the birds who are probably running out of food up in the mountains because it was such a dry summer.
Chris, do you have anything to add?
Yes, I just echo those comments that it's the really there was a tremendous impact of this the dry spring and early dry summer on a lot of the plants up at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, for example. A lupin, usually you would have fields of purple down in the valleys, in the East River Valley. It simply didn't happen this year. They did not set fruit. And so we're talking about a plant that dominates the meadows in those areas that they tried to set fruit. It came out early. The plant had seed, but they got hit by an early frost. So that's a huge food amount of food that's been taken out of the system. And I'm sure lots of other flowering plants that same thing happens to. I think there's going to be a deficit of fruit, of fruits for like species like evening grosbeaks eat.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We're going to talk a little bit about fruit and bears in a moment, but we have a caller calling from Paeonia. Maria is on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Maria.
Hi, Julia.
Hi. Do you have a question for Michael and Chris?
I do. I have been noticing since just before August 1st that there have been a lot of geese that seem to be gathering, and I've been hearing their honking and their flying, observing their flying patterns in the morning, and they just seem to be gathering and circling as they do in the fall. And it seems to me that that is very early for them to be doing this. I usually notice this around the end of August or the 1st of September when that starts happening. So I wondered if that's related to the fact that maybe we're going to have an early fall, and is that part of the whole climate movement?
Chris, do you have an answer for Maria?
Most likely those geese, Canada geese, which are expanding in North America, their population has been increasing over the last few years and last few decades. But they probably got an early start, like a lot of these other species we're talking about, mainly the ponds and the waters they that they prefer when they're moving back in, melted out up to a month or earlier, even earlier this year. So they got an earlier start, so they finished up their breeding most likely early and are starting their movement into their will eventually be their winter range.
Thanks for that. Michael, do you have any thoughts on geese in town that you've seen?
Not really. I think that Chris's answer was probably right. As good as we can get.
Yeah, I think it is, too. We'll definitely be exploring the theme of early fall on Icy Change in the coming weeks. I've heard people noticing that the leaves are changing on certain trees. Animal behavior that is indicative of fall. And, again, a lot of these patterns have been disrupted by the change of the seasons. So thank you. And speaking of animals being disrupted in terms of their patterns, we've been talking a little bit about bears. There have been ideas that maybe we'd be seeing them earlier this year. Michael?
Yes, I certainly anticipate that we'll be seeing a lot of bears this year in town, and particularly in the orchards, because there's been so little food. The berry crop in the mountains is probably zero this year because of the very dry summer. So the poor bears have to eat tons of food, literally tons of food, in order to get enough fat in their bodies to hibernate in the winter. So they tend to start gorging themselves in late summer. And there's no food up in the mountains to gorge themselves on this year, very little food. So they'll be coming down early looking for fruit on trees and looking for anything they can eat in garbage and towns. So I'm betting that we'll see a lot of bears in the towns on the western slope this fall.
Well, it was on your suggestion that I speak to your friend, Kirk Madriaga, who's the district wildlife manager in Paonia. And he says he hasn't received any reports that bears are coming down earlier than normal in the North Fork Valley. But he agrees with you that we might be seeing lots of them this year.
We may have more bears down for a couple reasons. Our water is low, so mid-level elevation water is actually gone in a lot of places where we normally have water. And the other reason would be that we are having a pretty, I wouldn't say catastrophic, pretty catastrophic food failure for bears. Their acorns that they usually eat in the late fall did not come on well. The berries that they eat right now are not there. They just didn't develop. And we had a late freeze that killed a bunch of the flowers. So they're really, really hungry up there. And so they could come down to people. And we always are stressing, keep your trash away from where bears can get it. Keep your barbecue grills, your bird seed, your hummingbird feeders away from where bears can get them. If you do have bears around, make sure that you don't do anything to allow them to get a meal at your house, because if they do, they have a good memory about where their last meal came from and they'll be back. And if you keep the stuff clean, you know, don't feed your cats overnight. Feed them in the morning so that there's no cat food left out overnight or no dog food left out overnight. Stuff like that to discourage the animal from being in or staying around people's houses. Make sure your garbage never gets to where the bear finds it. Keep it in a garage or something until it's garbage day and put it out. Those kind of things will help immensely. We have a lot of bears in the Aspen area that are in and around town right now, and they're having a lot of trouble with just these kind of things. Anything anybody can do to help discourage a bear from finding a meal and deciding this is good stuff, is we encourage them to do those kind of things.
So if there is a situation where a bear comes knocking, should they call you or should they just let it go?
It depends on the severity of the incident. If they see a bear and it just walks through the yard and you live on the outskirts of town, if you live in town or on the right close outskirts of town, maybe give us a call. But if you live where I live and a bear walks by, it's not all unusual. It's just that's where I live, so that's where the bears live. So it kind of depends on each incident whether we'd like to know or not. If a bear is aggressive towards you, yes, we would like to hear about that.
What's the number they should call if that happens?
I'm the district wildlife manager here in Paonia, and so you can call me directly at 970-527-4419.
I believe I heard that the bear family here in town had a sighting of a bear in their backyard. I don't know if the bear reads mail or knew that it was the bear family yard that they were playing in, but it was earlier in July.
I heard about the bear. Nobody called me and told me about it. The bear in the bear's yard is not unusual because it's right on the edge of town, and it wouldn't surprise me a bit if they had several of them, not all at once, but, you know, over the course of a month.
We also had a photo of a bear crossing Highway 50 submitted by Jeremy Puckett to the IC Change Facebook page. It was a bear crossing the highway in the desert, in the Dobies. Does that sound unusual to you?
Not really. We see bears all throughout the state, and there are always bears down in the Delta area. And it was probably going from the Gunnison River up to the Grand Mesa or vice versa. They wander quite a bit.
Oh, so then, you know, when they come down into town, maybe it's not just because they have a shortage of food or a shortage of water. It's just because they want to get from point A to point B?
Sometimes that's probably true, but usually when they come down here, it's because they have peaches at the end of the journey. Bears always come down when the peaches are ripe in this valley, and they get into the peach orchards and eat peaches until they can't move anymore. And maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I remember we had 10 bears in one orchard. So, and they were eating all of their peaches. Bears are all about food, and they just will follow their noses to wherever they find something to eat.
And they sure like those peaches that have come into season just this week. Is it because they fit in a bear hand? Is that why they like them so much?
They don't grab them. They just chomp them. And they are delicious. We all know that.
Well, I have been chomping myself, so I understand that completely. And speaking of peaches, you can see a video of a hummingbird nesting on top of a peach that we filmed at Delicious Orchards last week. It's pretty incredible. And you can just head over to the Icy Change Facebook page and the KVNF Facebook page. If you like what you see there, you can give us a like. We'll be posting more critter videos as we broadcast more of our radio stories on animals this month. We have Rita Claggett's question about double queen bees coming up next. We have Nancy Zimmerman's question about blossoming timings being off and how that relates to hummingbirds. And finally, we'll be hearing from Jason Beeson again about his lightning bugs. Amy Conley Hyunton has also been seeing lightning bugs this year, and we'll be finding out why it's so unusual to see them here in the Rocky Mountain West. I'm also going to talk about what we're looking forward to in terms of Icy Change. We're creating a digital farmer's almanac. We're calling out to anyone in the community who would like to help us. Just somewhere that we can all keep track of what's happening on our farms, our gardens, and ranches and recreation areas over time. We're looking for people who keep records, and we're really looking to talk to old timers, especially for our next round of stories. One of the criticisms that we've gotten about Icy Change is that, in terms of talking about change, is that old timers will tell you things change every day, every year, all the time, and we want to hear from you. We're going to do a live call-in show. We want your stories, suggestions, people to talk to, and we'll come to you. We're going to circle back to a question that we had from Eric Darby. It also kind of feeds into what Mason Lightfoot was seeing. He saw a rattlesnake, and people all over town have been seeing snakes and lizards. So Eric Darby on Sin Agua Mesa in Peonia says he saw scorpions for the first time and loads of lizards. Now, Sin Agua Mesa sounds like its namesake in Spanish. It's above the ditch on Pitkin Mesa, and it has very little water. So, Jeff, if you would play that scorpion clip.
It's extremely dry. So dry that the lizards love it, and evidently so do the scorpions. I was excited to see my first one, which was this summer. I've never seen them on my property prior to this. And then I lived 25 years on another mesa, never saw any scorpions there. The lizards are more plentiful and they're bigger. My question would be to ask the scientists what it is about the hot and dry weather that makes the lizards be so prolific.
All right. So, Michael, it sounds like you've been seeing loads of reptiles this year, too.
Well, I've seen lots of dead garter snakes on the roads, roadkill garter snakes.
Roadkill again.
But as the climate gets warmer, we're going to see more reptiles because reptiles need warmth to bask. They need to bask in order to get warm enough so they can hunt and escape predators. So I think these are all symptoms of gradual changes that we're seeing in the weather in the West. And that we'll see creatures that have lived further south, like scorpions, coming up the valley. Rattlesnakes are extremely rare here, but they occur in the Dobies a little bit. We'll be seeing more of those at higher elevations probably over the years as the weather changes.
And Chris, you mentioned that the snakes might be enjoying the winter in particular, that they may have survived in better numbers this year.
Yes,
like what Caitlin was talking about, species that hibernate, you go into hibernation with a certain amount of fat, and then you don't eat during that time. You have to live on that fat as if it were a fuel, like fueling your gas tank. And then the longer the winter is, the more likely you are you're going to burn up that fuel, and then you just don't come out of hibernation. You die. But the shorter winters, the earlier spring, hibernating species, like a lot of snakes, will have that critical period, that really harsh period for them is shorter, and so they come out of hibernation earlier with more reserves, and they can get moving and get out early and start reproducing early. As long as they don't, but however, the problem with that is the less snow you have, if you were to get an early cold snap, that might hurt them. They might not be ready for that, and there may not be any snow cover to cover them. But in the case of the snakes, yeah, definitely a shorter hibernation season is going to increase their survival chances.
All right. Well, I think we have time for one more question. We have a question from Amy Conley Hyunton. She posted to the IC Change Facebook page. She asked, is anyone else seeing northern leopard frogs around the valley? She says that Cooper, Nicoya, Mia, Zoe, Riley, and herself have seen some on the North Fork of the Gunnison. Any thoughts about northern leopard frogs?
I've seen leopard frogs here for years, but they're not common, but they're in places where there's permanent water. So it could be that they're reproducing better now because of the warmer weather, the earlier springs, and their populations are increasing, but I don't know any more than that about them.
Okay. Chris, any thoughts on the northern leopard frogs?
I really don't have anything to add to that.
Okay. Well, we're interested here at IC Change not only on how the changing weather and climate is affecting animals, but how it's affecting us in terms of our schedule, in terms of our lives, the economics, our farms, our ranches, our gardens. We're trying to collect all of this information and stories and daily observations. If you keep records about what you're planting, what you're harvesting, what's coming on time, what's a little early, what's a little late, we want to hear about it. So find us on our Facebook page, IC Change on Facebook. We're also taking emails, questions. You can email me at icchange@kvnf.org. And you can just find us in the studio. I'll be out again at Picking in the Park in Paonia with a microphone and some flyers. I'll also be at the Delta County Fair. And we'd love to hear from you. Again, we are definitely reaching out to old timers for our next question and answer session. And again, I would like to thank our guests, Michael Soule here in the studio and Chris Floyd calling us from the Ecological Society of America meeting in Portland, as well as every listener who has called or texted or posted on our Facebook page or simply come into the studio for a chat. Please continue to do so. Tell us what you're seeing and what your questions are. Text the word IC to 877-877. We'll be bringing answers to you for the rest of the year for all four seasons. So thanks, everyone. Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Chris.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you, Julia.
And that does it for Local Motion today. The segment you've heard will be posted on our website at kvnf.org. You're listening to us on KVNF 90.9 in Paonia and KVMT 89.1 in Montrose and on the web at kvnf.org. Stay tuned. Coming up next, All Things Considered.